Hi, I'm Adrian. And right this moment, there are tens of thousands of Black entrepreneurs around the world creating amazing startups that you've never heard about. For some reason, the mainstream media doesn't cover Black entrepreneurs as much as it should. But on this show, we find these amazing founders. We sit down with them. We figure out how they got their ideas launched, what their struggles were, what they're afraid of, what drives them. My hope is that you have enough firepower from listening to this show to go out there and start your own business. Or if you're working on something, continue plowing through it. Let's have an amazing time together. Welcome to the show. Hi, listeners. It's been a while. It's been a couple of months since my last episode. Since then, a tremendous amount of things have happened. I got into a startup accelerator. I started a new company and COVID. So there's definitely a lot to talk about and there's a lot to discuss. It's been an amazing journey. I miss being behind the microphone and I will be happy to tell you all about what's been going on. My new company is called Voice Blast, and we are going to take over the passion economy by helping creators build better relationships with their audience and monetize through various means. So super excited to tell you all about that. But before we jump into all that, I feel like I have some making up to do. So I've got a special guest. My next guest, Darrell Frater, was one of the entrepreneurs that probably was tuned in to watching DJ's live stream on Instagram during the lockdown. And we all had the same thought, like, wow, they're really missing an opportunity to monetize here. Darrell saw that opportunity and has built something really special, a product, an app that allows DJs to live stream and monetize at the same time. We had an amazing conversation. We spoke about everything from entrepreneurship, mindset, religion, faith, get into product market fit, which is where your product is really awesome, his journey to finding developers, his previous work, his 8 jobs and 8 things that he's completely up to. Amazing conversation, but let's get started on that. Enjoy. All right, Darrell, how's it going, man?
Good, brother. How are you today?
I am not doing as good as I would want to be, but you know how the founder life goes. So surviving. Another day, another quarter.
I hear that, brother. You got to be in there for the ups and the downs, but I'm here for you.
For sure, man. So I want to circle back to, so I was in this 2-day, I think it was Founders University camp by Jason Calacanis. And I remember like joining the call and there's a whole bunch of random people on there. It's like, oh, everybody's a founder here. Okay, cool. But like there was no coordination, like nothing was going on. And I just remember being like, what's going on here, man? Like, there's nothing happening. Is this a scam? Like, what's up? And then like you out of the blue just kind of stepped up and started organizing people. It's like, okay, cool. Like, let's start with this introduction thing. And, you know, let's do a little pitch thing going on. And to the point where by the time Jason and the sort of co-host came in, they weren't even sure if you were part of the crew or not. Like, they were just like, wait, like, who, like, what's going on? Did we hire this brother? Like, we don't know what's going on. So for me, I found that really interesting, but that shows to the leadership abilities that I saw on that day. And then I got cracking on the little spreadsheet thing that I did and I pushed it out there. But that was fantastic though. But fast forward to now, you've launched a product called In the Club, right? Where it's sort of what we all thought about when we saw D-Nice playing on Instagram. We're like, dang, like, how is he making money from this, right? Because it's like, well, you're spinning, you've got 100,000 people on here. People want to actually give you money, but people don't know what to do. I mean, there's a few cash apps floating around. We don't know if it's real or not, if it's fake. Walk me back to that point. Like, were you on those streams? What were you thinking about when this all this was happening?
Yeah, now we could jump right into kind of the story of how I started the Club app. And essentially, with my previous startup, Prom Social, it was a mobile app for teenagers to plan and shop for their prom. And with, COVID-19 and the pandemic, all the proms across the country were pretty much closed and canceled. So my role is the VP of Growth and Marketing. So I had to figure out ways to keep my students engaged on the app. So one thing we did was we hosted a virtual prom. And we worked with another startup called the Not Okay app and joined their virtual prom that they were hosting, and were able to get a lot of exposure and a lot of cool, excitement around that event. We had DJ Jazzy Jeff as the DJ for the virtual prom, and it got some exposure from Jack Dorsey, who's the CEO of Square and Twitter. He gave a 45,000 donation to the event, and we were able to give out money to the students for COVID relief. And it was just a really cool live stream virtual prom using Instagram Live. And that was like my first use case of seeing the power of live streaming in this day and age. And it was just so fun. The students really appreciated it. We had a red carpet with a lot of different celebrities that joined, and it was just like super powerful. And that was the beginning of May. And then after that, weeks later, there was the blow up of the Beanie Man versus Bounty Killer versus battle, and that was huge for me. I'm Jamaican, and when I just heard about it and tuned in, and the energy and the vibe, and just how many people was on the stream, it was another use case where I'm like, wow, here it is again. Live streaming is really championing this season while we're quarantined and people are not physically together to party and to engage. And again, then I got in touch with the Club Quarantines with DJ D Nice, and just been watching his movements on that. And I'm just like, there's so many of these use cases where live streaming is supplementing or replacing people's entertainment. And the events that were going on were only happening every couple of times a month. And then, like you said, there wasn't much ways for these people to monetize these huge events. So I'm like, man, there has to be a way for this to have its own space where the content is happening, the excitement is happening, but the people that are responsible for these experiences are being, compensated or have some incentive to do it. And that's when I just like, we got to jump into this. And I started brainstorming. I just went to start building a new live streaming platform that enables DJs and entertainers to host virtual parties and for the ability for them to be rewarded with an in-app tipping feature and cashing out that money very seamlessly. And that's how I came up with the club.
Yeah, so I'm probably like one of your first beta users. So I downloaded the app. I played around. I actually bought myself some points. I only spent the buck. So I'm probably like one of your the users you don't want. Only spent the buck. But what you're starting out is, Instagram is a huge platform. They have a billion plus users. You can go live on there and just capture the attention of people immediately. Now, you run the risk when you start a new product like this, as amazing as it sounds, of you having the two-sided marketplace problem, right? Where if anybody's not sure what the two-sided marketplace problem is, you need in Daryl's case, you need DJs to bring people, but you also have to have people there for the DJs to come. So how are you going about?
Yeah, no, it's a definitely a problem that all two-sided marketplace founders deal with, and our approach to this is one, building a community of DJs amongst yourself, so that way they're using it to DJ, but they're also using it as consumers. And as we build that community, they're going to also bring the consumers and the viewers themselves. And in regards to also establishing like a player one mode where the DJs are getting value from using the platform, even if there are massive amounts of viewers currently on the platform. And that's coming soon with some new features that are going to enable, a solo player one kind of mode where they get a lot of value just from streaming on the platform. And we're working on some developments that are pretty fun and cool for them.
Okay, and there's nobody else
There are
doing it?
no apps that are specifically tailored to the DJ community. There's a couple of general live streaming platforms that use similar models, but we are the only one that is building features and functionality and our branding and marketing specifically for the DJ and live party community.
How big is this market?
Just the market alone, you got to think about the global live streaming market and then also the global streaming market. And the global live streaming market is $70 billion, while the global live streaming market of music is $47 billion. So between those two markets, it's just a huge opportunity for music and live streaming and kind of combining those two to drive a lot of commerce and opportunity for people to make some really good money.
Yeah, no, I definitely see like the passion economy blowing up, platforms being built for and by creatives, because I'm assuming you're
a little bit
yourself. We'll get into that. We'll get into that. But okay. So walk me back, right? So Prom Social started that. That's going on right now. You're still working on that and you've got this new startup, or like, what's the setup? How are you splitting your time?
Yeah, so Prom Social, I am one of the co-founders. It was started a couple of years before I joined the team in 2019. And the founder, Edward, he's still chugging along and working hard on the project. And I'm still there as his right hand, just working on ways for them to continue to innovate and drive value to the users. So that's still going on. I would say I probably spend maybe 10 to 15% of my time on that. Bulk of my time is spent on the club. And then also I'm an MBA student at the College of New Jersey. So a portion of my time is spent in that. And super busy guy, but I also am a fellow at Score 3 Ventures, where we help underrepresented founders raise funding for their startups.
Man, that's a lot.
Yeah, yeah. That's only the tip of the iceberg. I didn't even speak about, you know, rental properties I own, businesses with my father, construction, custom cabinetry. I do a lot, brother.
Is it hustle culture 101? Are you doing too much? Do you feel like you're doing too much?
I feel like I'm not doing enough. I feel like, you know, I'm Jamaican. You know, all Jamaicans have like 7 to 10 jobs. And I feel like that it's just in my blood and my culture to be very active and very busy. I actually work at my peak performance when I'm just very busy and I have things back to back to back to back to work on. And I just love that high pace, high speed, high productive just mindset. It just helps me move quickly and just helps me continue going throughout my day and just being super productive.
Okay, so, and I guess the reason why I'm asking this is because when everything that I've ever read, because I haven't felt that just quite yet, that says that once you're working on a product and you get true product market fit, it pulls you. Like, you know, it pulls you into this vacuum. You can't possibly be doing anything else or being involved in anything else because the startup is just growing so fast. Is it the case of you're working on all these other things, right? And one of them eventually is going to turn into a wildfire and just consume all of your time, where you're going to have to drop the rest? Or is it the case of, regardless of what happens, I'm still going to be working on all these different
things? Well, I like to optimize my activities by putting systems in place that allows it to work with or me not being involved. So what I tend to do is, how can I outsource as much of the things I can as possible and use my time where it's worth the most value? And I do that by hiring contractors. I do it by putting software technology in place where things are pretty much on autopilot as much as possible. And that gives me the free time to leverage my time in the best way possible. It's working so far. And then, like you said, as things scale up, I'm going to have to continue to adjust my strategy. But, you know, as long as I'm keeping up high quality performance on all the items that I work on, I'm going to continue doing it until it reaches a point where my activity within these projects are failing the project because I don't have enough time. And that's when I, you know, either hand it off to someone else or kind of bow gratefully.
Right. Gotcha. So previously you spoke about fundraising, right? Very briefly. So you got the idea for In the Club, right? You're sitting there, you're going, I should probably build this thing. Are you a software developer? Like, how do you go from that point where it's like idea to, 'cause you ship the product now, it's in the app stores.
Talk to me about that process. What is that like? How you walk into that process? Who do you reach out to? How much does it cost? Like, what's that short?
Yeah, I came up with the idea on June 4th, 2020, and as of today, it's been about 4 months and change since the idea came about. It took me about 3 months to get a product that was ready for the App Store, and since, you know, I am not a developer, but I have worked with Prompt Social building a mobile app for a year and a half. And with the experience of being able to help our developers in terms of kind of giving them direction with that app, when I contracted a new team to work on the club app, I was able to use my experience and my understanding of, you know, how users respond to certain features and what's needed and how to make it simple enough to where adoption could be very seamless, and just kind of understand what aspects of your app are important and what aspect are not. And it's very important to understand your kind of your product roadmap, because you can build the right product, but kind of build it in the wrong order and it doesn't capture the value that the users need in the short term to be able to grow your company into the long term. So for me, you know, that process of finding the right dev team for me was to find an outsourced one that was high quality in terms of the quality of the work, but fair in the pricing. And you'll see that there's dev teams that have pricing and quality standards all across the map. And you got to be able to navigate through them all and see who's going to be the best partner for you, given the amount of funding you have and the speed that they operate and the quality of their work. So, you know, I literally did a lot of research, read a lot of articles, read a lot of reviews on sites like Clutch and different developer review sites, and was able to find a team that was very good and really helpful to launch this product at a really good price.
How much did it set you back?
I don't call it a setback. I call it an investment, but it depends on, you know, how complicated your project is and how good you are at project management. So for me, this cost me maybe anywhere between 40 and 60 in development, and probably another 10 to 15 on top of that for other expenses just to launch the app. So it's really doable by anyone that, you know, is willing to take the risk and jump into something. It's super helpful if you have already done it before, or you have some guidance from someone that has done it before, because they, and depending, and this also goes into your decision on who you hire, they might not have too much direction and you got to kind of hold their hand, or they might have a direction, but that's not what you need for it to be a high scalable business that people want to actually use. So it's like you have to have the kind of skill set to know what's going to be valuable for the users and the people that you're trying to serve with your app. And that's something that I think I got a good grasp on, and kind of one of my competitive advantages by being a second time mobile app founder.
Okay. So when you're, I mean, that's some people might be like, okay, yo, that's a lot of money, right? I think by any standards, that is a lot of money. And you are right. It's not a setback. It's an investment for sure. You invest in your ideas, your vision. But what exactly is going through your mind to give you that amount of conviction? So, you know what, man, I'm going to spend over 50K to build this thing because I know the world wants it. Like, what are the signals? Because I'm asking this because a lot of people have ideas. It's, oh, this is a great idea to do. Like, but how do you be like, you know what, if this doesn't get built right now, like, I'm not going to be able to sleep well, right? It's going to be on my mind. You know, I'm yeah. a founder too. I get it, right? You know, you think about it all the time. You're like, man, the possibility of this thing blowing up. It's, you know, and you just can't get it out of your body yeah. until you build it, right? But what's going through your mind? What makes you so sure that the world like needs this product? Because I understand yep. the problem, but what makes you sure that A, it needs it, and B, you're the person to build it?
Yeah, I believe that I was uniquely positioned to just go for it. And if I move quickly, it's going to increase the likelihood of it succeeding given the time that we're in with this coronavirus pandemic. And my skill set being someone that founded a mobile app before is also my connections in the VC space as a fellow at Score 3. And also my connections in college. I threw some of the largest parties through my fraternity, Kappa Alpha Psi. And I was one of the leaders, part of a huge barbecue here in New Jersey that I got connected to a lot of DJs. And just really a lot of context in the space. So I'm uniquely positioned for this, and that's kind of why I jumped into it. I didn't have this goal of, oh, growing up and starting an app like this. It kind of just popped up in terms of the opportunity, and, you know, I had conviction to go forward with it. And conviction is very important when you're launching a startup or doing anything in life, because if you back out midway, that's what causes you to fail, not because you had a bad idea or not because it wasn't going to work. It's just because you gave up too soon. And for me, I'm a person of faith, and my faith in my religion and just being able to trust that everything is going to work out in the end, it just helps me go forward every single day. And I know that it doesn't matter how hard I try. It really is a power above me that is going to be able to help guide and help me get through all this. So for me, it's kind of me having confidence in myself as a founder, but then also having, you know, faith in Christ and allowing me to continue and move forward each and every day, knowing that someone else has my back.
That, okay, so that's enough conviction to get you started, for sure. What are we doing next? Are we trying to raise some money for this thing? Are we bootstrapping to success? Are we keeping all our company? Are we going to sell some to some hungry VCs? What's the direction? Like where we go?
Yeah, it really depends on the opportunity. So ideally, I want to be able to bootstrap this and go all the way and retain as much equity as possible. And, you know, my goal in life is to play a major role in closing the racial wealth gap. So what I want to do is, after I hit a certain point within growth of my company, be able to do like an equity crowdfunding round and have the users of my platform, the DJs and the people that are just, you know, advocates of what we're doing and believe in the mission, to be able to have ownership in this business and kind of crowdfund some funding for this platform. But, you know, having VC money, having investors at this early stage allows me to move faster. So I'm not super active in investing or finding investors right now, but, you know, I'm passively, you know, throwing my deck around. And if I find a partner or investor that aligns very well in terms of not just the capital, but in terms of their connections and expertise within the live streaming and music space, then if there's a proper fit, then I would be glad to have them on board, not as just investors, but as strategic partners. And that would be valuable to me. So it's really about what opportunity comes forth. Otherwise, you know, just want to take it day by day and see what comes in my way.
So with live streaming, how does this work, right? Can you live stream music that's copyrighted, or do you need approvals first, right? Because it gets sticky after a while, right? Because, you know, if you build like a Spotify sort of platform where you're streaming the audio from a server, right? Like, you can't do that unless you get like approvals from the record labels, right? But in this case, you're playing music and you're streaming your environment, right? What are some of the technicalities there? What are the loopholes that as a startup you're going to like find your way in? Because every startup has to have a loophole that they sort of exploit. You know, how does it
work? So that's a very interesting topic. And this is one of the reasons why we have a competitive advantage in the space. Instagram, Facebook, you know, even Twitch and these other live streaming platforms do not kind of want to play in that world where they're paying a lot of money for these music licenses, especially with their operations. They're not a core music platform. So it's really not into their business model to be able to afford and pay for these licenses. That's why they have so many issues and so many takedowns on their platforms. My company specifically focus on live music entertainment within our platform. So I made sure to acquire all the licenses I need from day one to operate. So that's working with the different PRO licenses agencies such as BMI, ASCAP, CSAC, and just making sure that you have the proper licenses to play music legally. And at the end of the quarter, I pay out royalties to the owners of the music that's played on my platform. And you can use different technologies, just like on Instagram, how they know when you're playing a song that you shouldn't be playing. There's technology, the same similar technology that can record and tell you, hey, these are the songs you played, so I know what royalties to pay out. And it's important to do so because it's cool in the short term, you know, save a couple of dollars here and you know, find those loopholes. But if you want to be in business for real and you want to sit at the table and be a real business founder that's doing real deals with real legitimate companies, you want to do it the right way, because these guys, girls, these people that run these corporations have been in it for years, and you don't want to get on their bad side. You want to be able to be their partners and not steal from them, because you got to think about it like this. The artists and the people and the writers and all the people involved in making music, they work hard and they have talent that allows them to make these things that people love and enjoy across the world. So without paying the proper licenses, you're stealing from them. And that is not right to steal from anyone. So my platform, I make it my business to make sure that everyone eats, everyone's getting paid, and everyone's enjoying themselves while we're all building this community together.
But startups primarily, like, are these disruptive things that erupt and sort of upset the status quo, sort of anti-corporation, you know, grassroots, we're doing this, sort of freeing the people from this chains of the corporate side. So a part of me has to ask, like, what part of this product is doing that? And I know that, you know, sort of like the Silicon Valley, like, mantra of be like, you know, like disrupting the industry in some way, there has to be something that, you know, you're sort of taking a swing at the big insert industry, whether it's big Kool-Aid or big, you know, whatever the case may be. What part of this platform is actually doing
that? Yeah, so I think you're referring to the Silicon Valley culture of move fast and break things. And I'm here to challenge that mantra. I believe that we're in a day and age where if you are strategic, smart, innovative, it's actually in your favor to move fast and fix things as opposed to moving fast and breaking things. That's kind of the lazy way of innovation. And I feel like true innovators know how to do things the right way, where everyone is benefiting from the things that you're doing and you're not hurting other people in some way, shape, or form with your innovation. So I'm, you know, really just using my, you know, intellect and using my ability to build relationships with the right corporations and individuals that are already in the space to move forward with what I'm doing. And the thing is, if I'm making everyone happy and if I'm making sure that all parties are receiving the rewards they should get from their skills, talents, and property, intellectual property, it's a win-win for everyone. And I'm able to do that as a solo founder, and it still makes sense economically because I'm super lean with my operations. If I was a big corporation and I had millions of, you know, dollars and that I have to play out to employees and other, you know, kind of expenses for my company, and it makes it much more difficult economically to be able to afford doing the right thing. So you got to think about that in your operations. If you're very lean, then you have the extra capital to do things that you don't have to break in order for it to work. So I challenge you, if you're a startup founder, if you're looking to do something big, try to see what ways you can be very lean and still abide by the rules. Now, there's going to be some things that are not going to work in the short term because economically you're just starting out and you're not going to be able to afford it. But how can you work that into your model as soon as possible, or you're thinking about it as you build and you can have the conversations with the people and let them know, like, hey, this is what our plans are. You know, we're early stage, we're building into this and we're going to do this the right way, but we need your help. And if you're able to, you know, kind of picture that image of how you're going to, you know, help them make money in the long term, if they help you in these early stages, they might bite and they might support you as you try to move quickly and fix things. And that's the way I operate.
No, for sure. I think that, you know, the sort of the move fast and break things model has created a lot of companies that have been very problematic with how they run at their core. But it also seems to be one of the key igniters of innovation. Questionable, it's debatable, but it's what we've seen right now. So backtrack to like the business side of things. How much money could this product eventually make? Let's call it, you know, 2 years from now. What's your balance sheet like?
Yeah, man, I really believe that in 3 years, we could be doing 100K a quarter. Sorry, way more than 100K, 100 mil a quarter, some like these other live streaming platforms in the industry that are killing it, especially in Asia. Asia has really taken on live streaming as a way for entertainment and commerce. And I believe that, you know, my company going in from an entertainment route could make 100 million per quarter within 3 years. And that's what these other platforms are doing across seas. And I'm taking an innovative approach to kind of mirror some of their success and try to do it in an industry that's booming and needed right now.
Yeah, good. That's a good point to bring up, right? Because in Asia, it kind of works differently. They have a different culture of how they consume content. Do you think that the sort of the U.S. is behind when it comes to adopting live streaming technologies and social live streaming? Or is there a case of it's just we just need the big app to emerge and everybody will sort of jump on? Or as a society, are we not there yet? Are you ahead of the game right now and just building and just waiting on people to get to that
point? Yeah, I definitely think they're much ahead in Asia in terms of adopting live streaming as a entertainment platform and then also as a commerce. And I believe that through my approach, using entertainment is a way to break in the U.S., the European and African markets to adopting live stream. So that's my approach. And I'm hoping that I can, you know, be that platform that encourages mass adoption and be able to get people to see the power of live stream, just how I was able to see it and see what ways that we can leverage this in our everyday lives.
I think the last question I would ask about the business side of things would be like, so I use the app, right? So I got on and I saw a couple of events. So I picked one. I said, okay, DJ, insert name that I don't know. I said, okay, click on that one. And then when the stream started, I jumped in and it's playing music. I'm like, okay, great. Let me do this clap little icon thingy here, like a reaction. I click on that. It says you need some points. You need to buy some points to give to DJ. I'm like, nah, I'll wait a little bit, right? And I do it again. Just because I saw a lot of people clapping as well. I was like, oh, you know what? You know, screw it. So I pay for a buck. I get some points. I spend it. Is that primarily how the app makes money? Is there some other mechanism? Or is this just a million people on a Lady Gaga live stream? And during that hour, you know, she gets paid out $500,000 because everybody's clapping their asses off, right? Is that it, or is there another mix?
That is the core component of how creators monetize on the club. As you said, you know, our point system is called Applaud Points, AP. So you buy the AP, and then you give the AP to the creators you want to support on their live stream. And then those supporters, when you give them AP, it converts to fame, which is our currency that we have that they are able to cash out into actual dollars straight to their bank account. So that is the core of our business model. And as we proceed and build out, we're going to have other ways for them to monetize, such as giving them portions of ad revenue, giving them, you know, portions of sponsorship revenue, you know, ability to be booked virtually and being booked for live events. We're going to allow, you know, for easy ways for them to be discovered by users so that way they can build their business on and off our platform. Merchandise and just so many different ways to capture value and to create value at the same time, where there's going to be ways for people to really make a lot of money on this platform. And you can even look at you know, examples from OnlyFans, which is, you know, primary use for bad things, but we're taking, you know, their approach of they're enabling creators to make money in different ways on their platform. And we want to take that same kind of philosophy of helping creators make money, but doing it in a very conscious way that is clean and safe and fun for all, and not, you know, pervert it in any way, and just really about the music and really about the creators on our platform.
I get it. So we got potentially 3 years from now, you don't 100 mil a quarter, apps booming. How many people do you need to get to that point? And what's your plan from now to get to the first, let's call it 50K or 100,000 users?
Yeah, I can't tell you too much about, you know, how many it's going to take in 3 years to reach that point. As someone that, you know, look at pitch decks every day with Score 3, I don't really, you know, weight financial projections or projections for startups too far out, because 90% of the chance they're wrong. But in the short term, we just need to acquire as many DJs and as many streamers and as many viewers as possible. And then we'll be able to kind of determine those numbers that determine how successful you are as a business, such as ARPU, which is annual revenue per user, and LTV, lifetime value of those users, and are able to calculate, you know, how much money or how many people it's going to take to reach those milestones. It's kind of, you kind of calculate it and see as you go along, and kind of we'll just take it day by day.
I want to know how you're hacking this, right? Because like someone out there has launched their app, they're just looking at thing at the store and it's not growing. I want to know what the hack is. Like, how do you plan on hacking this, right? To get people in? What's the primary? I mean, you don't have to give us the full game plan, but you know, what strings are you pulling across the webs to get people in?
Yeah, man. Strategic partnerships with some of the best in the industry, and working with influencers in the DJing space. There are hundreds of thousands, 700,000 DJs globally that are now, you know, without their primary source of income, which is parties, clubs, weddings, and venue, you know, events. And we're providing a space for them to monetize their audience. And like I said, as we build out more features and more things that enable them to do so even better on the platform, we're going to have a natural organic growth. Because when people are making money, they want to tell other people that, hey, this is how I'm making money, and kind of grow the community. But there's also going to be, you know, really cool partnerships with some great influencers in the space that are going to help activate and get the brand awareness of the club into the consumers, because it's not as easy as you may think to get people to adopt your new platform. You know, it has to make sense for them. There has to be a lot of alignment in the branding, in the incentive, in the messaging, in the fun, in the entertainment. There just has to be that perfect story of why I should spend my time on your platform as opposed to all the other apps like Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, TikTok, whatever. It's a competition of your time. And it's also a competition of your dollars as well, because if you're expected or you have the, you know, notion to tip a DJ, you know, there's a lot of, you know, decisions that kind of go on in your head that kind of have to, you know, align for that conclusion of you spending time on the platform and tipping a DJ or a streamer. So there's a lot that goes in place to make that happen. And when done properly, that's when the result of, you know, people supporting these DJs, and you kind of build that community where people know that this is what we do here.
Yeah, I think a huge part of it is also just being lucky, but not the kind of luck where, you know, it's just like you sat at home, you had the idea and you just waited. It's more like I'm putting all these things in motion, right? Like I'm twisting these buttons, I'm talking to these people, I'm promoting here, I'm jumping on this podcast, doing this post on Instagram, on LinkedIn. And then eventually something just kind of tips. Like, you know, if you ever read The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell, he talks about stuff like this, you know, why do things tip? And I think with startups, you're sort of playing that same game where you just like, okay, I'm going to put everything in the smelting pot, right? And we're just going to crank up the heat and something's going to happen, right? Someone's going to tweet at D Nice in the club, check this out. He's going to be like, oh shit, I'm in, let me check this thing out. And then from that point on, you just tip, right? So I guess the part of me is like saying, okay, what's the hack? The hack is just the hustle, right? You just put it and throwing everything at it. But when it comes to these partnerships that you're talking about, right, how are you approaching them? Because I know a lot of early stage founders who have products that can be strategically aligned with influencers in the industry. But how do you go about that? I mean, are you walking up to these folks and saying, okay, I'll pay you X amount of dollars? Are you saying, okay, I'm going to give you equity? You know, we all heard about the graffiti guy that did the Facebook thing and his $50,000 turned to $200 million, right? Are you comfortable giving equity out to influencers? And what are these deals like?
Yeah, so I'm going to kind of take a step back and touch back on your original point of kind of how people get successful. And in a startup and kind of just in general, it's like a J curve of success. You know, you start out very, you know, slow and not really have a strong progressing of your success, but eventually you just shoot up crazy with your success. And that's because once you hit that point of acceptance and adoption from the masses of the people that have influence. Everyone else wants to join the bandwagon and everyone wants to attach themselves to that success. So you kind of have that, you know, once you break that kind of that ceiling and you just go exponentially quickly with your growth. And that's kind of the same way that these kind of partnerships and deals have been aligning. You know, people that discover me or people that have within my network kind of tell other people about what's going on. And when it clicks and they get it, and they see other people involved, they're like, oh, this is new. This is about to take off. I want to join the rocket ship. And that's how these, you know, partnerships and deals are coming my way. And we're signing some contracts this week. This is actually a big contract week for me. And just trying to close some deals and work out some amazing partnerships all across the world. Some in Africa, some in the UK, and a lot here in the United States, specifically in Miami, Florida. Some in LA and some in New York. So, got some great things coming in. I can't wait to make these announcements.
Are these equity deals or all cash?
Some cash, some revenue share, one equity so far. So yeah, there's different ways to structure these deals. You just have to kind of make it align with your ultimate goals and know what makes sense with your business. I'm very high in my conviction of how successful this is going to be. So I have to take my time or be very smart about equity and make sure that, you know, you're able to manage your ownership and just be able to retain it for the long term and be able to strategically use it in a smart way.
I agree with that. If you're not convicted, then you probably shouldn't be a founder because you just have to be. It's so freaking hard. It takes so long. It takes so much money and effort out of you that you should really be sure that this thing is going to be big. But backtracking a little bit away from the startup, let's talk about like, what was the first thing you sold, right? You're Jamaican. You're an entrepreneur. I think those two go hand in hand. So you've probably been selling like, you know, cakes or shoes back at school. Like how did everything start out? Yeah. Man, like what was do you remember your first sale? Like what was the first thing you sold?
Think it was candies and sodas in school.
And did you get in trouble?
I get in trouble. I would say my first, you know, work was just working with my dad on his properties and just kind of having the work ethic to work hard and to do that. And then also it's kind of crazy, but my video game playing as a kid actually gave me a lot of discipline. I was the type that would play video games a lot and I was super competitive and I would not just beat the games, but I would go back and complete them and get 100% on every single game, like every little aspect, like Super Mario, like get all the stars, you know, like all the, like the Mario Karts, get like win all the races and get, you know, all the highest points and just, I was just super competitive and me and my brother kind of fed off each other and kind of build our, you know, our work acumen and just to be able to challenge ourselves to the limits in working with my father in selling, you know, stuff in school, even in sports and nonprofit work and extracurriculars. It kind of just seen throughout all the aspects of our lives, just kind of our teaching from our parents of working hard and just kind of working towards your future.
Yeah. You know, so it sounds to me like you've always been on the entrepreneurial track. It was always going to happen. What's your personal driver? Like, you know, you are obviously involved in a lot of stuff, you know, you are, you know, doing a lot. Hoping to achieve a lot as well at the same time, but you know, why are you doing this? Right. There's a lot of ways that you can live your life right now where I'm pretty sure that you can get a comfortable job, be making decent money, have your nights and weekends to do whatever you want to do. You know, why do you choose to be an entrepreneur and sort of spend all this time and effort, you know, doing all these other things?
You know, for me personally, I couldn't be anything else but an entrepreneur. I don't thrive in an employee environment. You know, I am an innovator. I'm someone that always likes things to be improving and getting better and better each day. So I find myself combating with leadership in the previous jobs I had. And it's like, they just want to maintain their job. They don't want to take any risk. And they just want to get their paycheck week after week. And I'm like, yo, let's do things better. Let's innovate. Let's make improvements. We might mess up, but that's okay. They don't have that mindset. I don't thrive in a low risk, you know, environment. I take risk every single day. I mess up every single day, but it's all a part of the journey. And you got to be willing to not be afraid of failure. And for me at this point, I don't see failure. Like it's just a part of the process. It's a stepping stone to success. And if you don't have that mindset, it's pretty hard to take steps forward each and every day. If you're afraid to fail and make mistakes.
So talking about screwing up, I've got a long list of screw ups. But I want to know some of your, like, what are your top two that you're willing to share where you completely messed up, and what was it and how did you recover from those?
Man, it's so even hard to even pinpoint, because there's so many micro fails that happen every single day. The biggest one is, for me, it's not really a failure, it's just a part of the journey. But one of my hypotheses of the club was being able to launch with the current features that I have. And for me, I'm like, yo, this is good enough to put out there. I'll put it out there. And the market has told me that I need more for my DJs and the streamers to adopt it over these other platforms today. And there's a handful of DJs that, you know, see the vision, and that gives them, you know, the motivation to continue to stream. But for the masses, it's not enough. So I have to continue to build more to be able to satisfy the marketing and compete with their attention and time and, you know, and streaming capacity. You got to go out there and do it and learn as you go. And that's kind of the risk that you got to take. But people sometimes, especially when they're launching their new platforms or startups, they try to wait for the perfect moment to launch. And it's not really about that. It's how can I launch as quickly and often as possible and continue to get feedback from my, you know, users and learn from them and iterate on my value proposition to them. That's something that I've learned from YC Startup School. They have a free online course that teaches you kind of the way to think as a startup founder especially of a tech company, because it's not really about making everything perfect. It's about being okay with imperfection and learning as you go along and quickly iterating and making adjustments as you go along.
I think it was Paul Graham, the actual founder of YC, that said if you're happy with your startup, you launched too late. You should be pushing the button on launch thinking, man, this looks like shit, or like, this is not ready yet. Like, and that's the perfect time to get it out there, because you're not going to do all the innovation in a vacuum, right? Innovation, I think that this is probably something that is a misconception, that innovation actually happens in a vacuum, right? It's like, okay, one incredible entrepreneur goes into a dark room and like thinks of everything that is going to need to be built on this product, does it, comes out, and everybody just jumps on it. It's like, whoa, absolutely nothing ever works like that, right? Not even movies work like that, right? Movies actually, they'll shoot and then they'll do pre-screens, right? And they'll actually get people to come in and actually view it, and they'll rewrite the jokes again. So even that is an iterative process, right? So you just got to ship this thing early. But if you could go back, right, when, let's not talk about like in the club, let's go previously in the club, I mean, your early 20s, right? What advice would you give that version of yourself right now, given everything you know to this point?
Man, for that, I'm going to have to go to religion on that one. For me, I grew up a Christian, and my family is a strong Christian home, and I kind of was a Christian based on their faith. But over the past 2 years, I've been a Christian of my own faith, and I wish I was able to kind of be into it on my own as early as possible in life, because some of the things I learned and the wisdom that I've obtained just by reading the Bible and learning from the Word has helped me tremendously in my everyday decisions. And it's kind of hard to explain, but once you get into it, it's like unlocking a new set of wisdom that you just wouldn't have otherwise. And for me, it's been super impactful. It's been super powerful, and I credit a lot of my success to it.
So what would the advice be?
Start reading your Bible as early as possible and get into the Word and spend the time with God.
Okay, fair enough. So we're looking at, let me see here. We've got, so you're VP of growth at the
Prom Social,
right? And growth is hard, right? What are some of the core principles of how you grow stuff on the web, right? Let's not even talk about like apps, because a lot of people have ebooks. I mean, I've seen some ebooks do well over $5-10 million, right? Like, so the app is not the only thing that you can build on the web, people. Like, there's a lot of stuff you can do. I mean, I saw someone like launch a set of icons for the new iPhone, the new update, and they're making well over 15K already. That number's probably gone up by now. But in terms of growing stuff on the web, like, what are some of the core principles that you can share, being that you have experience with growth marketing?
Man, I would say product, man. You have to make sure that you're constantly spending time, money, resources on improving your product and making sure that it's solving a problem that is meaningful to a large number of people. And if you're doing that and you're successfully addressing that problem with your product, that is how you grow. You hit the term that we call product market fit, where we believe that, you know, the product is so good that it enables more people to share it with other people. And, you know, once you hit that point, that's when you supercharge on marketing and ad spend and getting, you know, paid acquisition to kind of hyper grow that viral growth of your company. But until you hit that point where if you invite someone or spend to invite someone, that's not going to generate more people or more dollars to your revenue line. It's important just to improve your product as much as possible. Because I would even say with Prom Social, I spent a lot on marketing before it was ready to be marketed. And you kind of spend, acquire, and they churn, as opposed to spending in your business or your product. That's going to be, you know, indefinite. You know, that's going to be something that you are benefiting from forever, you know, in perpetuity. But if you're spending on ads and marketing when it's not ready, you'll acquire them and they'll churn, and it kind of be almost a waste.
Yeah. You know, I've learned personally just from my journey that as a startup, you know, your marketing dollars should be about zero. So you should pay nothing for marketing. And you're right. Focus on product. So, okay. So let's walk through this framework, right? So ideally we want people to tell other people about your product, right? That is the best form of marketing, right? When someone can understand what you're building and explain it to their friend, say, hey, you need to download this app. Now, that's important because you trust your friend and you know if that they're using something that they like, you like it too, right? No company can have that level of intimacy with somebody, right? Like, I mean, the ultra huge brands can, right? Because they've built that trust up to that point. So ideally, you're looking to infect a few people with your vision and get them to tell other people and then them to get other people. So ideally, it goes from product to getting people to this aha moment. It's like, oh, now I get this thing. Everybody needs to know about this, right? But between that point where you build a product and when you get those first people, right, how do you reach those people? How do you find them?
Yeah, so if you're solving a problem, you should know who is the people with the problem. So you got to find where those communities are living and how do you, you know, kind of ingrain yourself into that community wherever they're at, where you're meeting them, where they're at with some type of value proposition that makes sense to where they can, you know, build that trust in you because you're solving that problem for them. And then kind of making it very easy for them to understand that you're solving a problem. They test it out, they try it, they get that problem solved and are motivated enough to tell people that you solved their problem. And it's kind of the, you know, the theory of social proof and just how people kind of don't really make decisions on their own as much anymore. They kind of, you know, see what other people are doing and need validation and trust from other people. So that way you're kind of borrowing the trust from the person that introduced them to your product and allowing them, hey, I don't trust the product, but I trust this person that recommended it to me. So now I trust the product, and kind of using them as social proof and getting trust from the relationships that they have is really a great way to growing, because there's just no better way. That people don't trust marketing like that anymore, you know, and if you don't have a brand, especially if you're a startup, it's really hard to get people to adopt your product. So, you know, social proof, even press and you know, being able to be in the newspapers and stuff like that. Like when other people with a brand are advocating for you, it just really helps push your brand along so much quicker, because you can DM and talk to as many people as you want, but without the relationship, it's really hard to kind of break through and get them to build that trust within you.
Yeah. And a huge part of it I've just found is just being like FOMO, right? Someone feels like if they're not using something, then their version of life is incomplete, right? It's like, yeah, if you see all the DJs on this product and you're not on there, then something must be wrong, right? So I think for anybody out there who is building something new, like just find your core audience. It doesn't matter if it's 10, 20, 30 people, like you're not going to reach 1,000 people at the start, right? So get that initial core audience, turn them into the believers, and they'll tell other people about you and your product. I think the last thing I'd probably like want to get out of you is, you know, when it comes to like the startup world, obviously Black founders are underrepresented. Right. You're sort of part of the venture world as well. So you can see this. What do you think is the problem? And as a collective, how do we overcome that? Right. How do we get, you know, $2-3 million checks off the bat? Right. Or, you know, when do you see that actually turn in? And, you know, what do we have to do to get to that point?
Yeah, man, it's not easy to raise funding, and it's not easy to raise funding if you're Black. Or if you're a minority, it's just a thing in the industry there where they, you know, don't see the opportunity in Black founders. And it's like, how do we change that? And the thing is, it's hard to change people. But what you can do is change the investors and have more people that look like us become investors. And that's part of my goal. Like I said, my mission in life is to play a major role in closing the racial wealth gap. And I feel like that can be done through entrepreneurship and investing. So we have more people that look like us that are entrepreneurs, but then we also have more people that look like us that are funding these entrepreneurs. And you know, Barack Obama's, you know, administration came up with the Title III of the Jobs Act, which is the ability for non-accredited investors to invest in early stage startups. Things like that enables for crowdfunding opportunities to where we can empower each other by being investors in early stage startups and companies. So I think that through investing in entrepreneurship, more founders of color and more investors of color, we can definitely move the needle on that. And as we are able to show more examples of Black success, it would be clear that, hey, if you do not invest in minority investors or in minority startups, you're actually missing out on economic opportunity, then the whole paradigm is going to shift. Because right now, a lot of them see it as, oh, this is just good to do because of the disparities in terms of, you know, the racial economic investment between, you know, whites and non-whites. And it's like, once they see that economically, it's better for them because these, you know, Black founders are bringing a unique spin to the table and are able to, you know, address markets that our white counterparts could never have, you know, addressed. We're going to be able to see that it's going to be a huge shift, and that's going to take time. It's going to take effort, and it's going to take people like me and you to have successful startups that prove out that this is a place where investors can earn massive returns on these kind of founders.
I agree with that. I think there's a second wave of Black founders right now sort of erupting. And I think it's pretty cool to see this community form. I think for me, being a founder myself and being a podcaster, I talk to a lot of people. I know a lot of Black founders, and I can see the early beginnings of all the companies starting off right now. You know, 5-6 years from now, everybody will know about these companies, but it's all forming right now. And I think my hope and my vision is that a lot of the founders right now who are, let's call it like the millennial founders, will go on to build successful businesses and in turn become LPs and become fund managers and become angel investors. And I think that's how we're going to able to sort of level the playing field for the Gen Zs and the alphas that are coming up. But I'm going to ask one last thing before we jump off here. It's been amazing talking to you, man. Like, what are some of your core principles that you live with, right? That guide you through entrepreneurship, life, risk taking, and just getting things done? And you know, where do you get that inspiration from and where you get that knowledge from? And what are these principles?
Yeah, I really believe that you just got to have faith and just believe that things are going to work out. And just attack it head on and understanding that even if you fail today, that doesn't mean you're a failure. You know, you're going to stumble, but as long as you continue to get back up and keep moving forward, things are going to work out. Life is long. If you mess up on your next five startups and then hit it on the number six, you're still successful. So like, don't ever think that everything has to work out on the first go around, because most likely it will not. So go out there. If you have an idea, figure out ways that you can attack it today. You know, don't be afraid to take risk and understand yourself. Be very self-aware to know how much risk you can take and feel comfortable. You know, for me, you know, I invested 60+ K of my own money into this new startup, and I'm okay with losing every bit of that. If it goes to zero and it fails, I am A-okay. Money well spent. But if you don't have that risk tolerance, and if you did that and it would kill you inside that you lost all that money, you have to be self-aware before you make those decisions, because you won't be able to do it comfortably and you won't be able to do it with a lot of conviction. So you have to be self-aware and then kind of just go ahead and take the risk.
Right. So we've got risk taking, self-awareness, believing in yourself. Give me two more.
I would say relationships. You know, for me, relationships are the single most important thing in the world. And if you are a good steward of relationships and are able to nurture and foster relationships with key people within your industry, people that can elevate and move things forward, and people that, you know, you may not even think would have any impact, and just being a good, you know, a person that builds relationships with people, things will come around. Because some people I've built relationship with 3 years ago, long before the club was even an idea, I was just being a good person at building relationships. And now those relationships are helping me tremendously in the club. So it's like building relationships long before you need them is so important. Because if you're building relationships when you need them, there's that misalignment of trust where people are not going to trust you. Because you think, oh, you're just talking to me because you want my help with this thing, as opposed to caring about me as a person. So that's pretty much kind of, you know, a double whammy. You know, just building relationships is so important. If you don't take anything else from this, I think that's one of the most important things you can take away.
I agree with that, man. Relationships are everything. Find a way to talk to people way before you ever think you're going to build a startup. Just be a good human, right? Help other people out, you know, download founders apps that you hear about, use it, tell your friends about it. It's a great way to help out the community. So where do you hang out on the webs, man? Where can people find you? What are your social handles? Do you accept DMs? You prefer people to write you via email? If someone out there wants some advice, you know, where can they reach out to you?
Yeah, I always make myself very accessible, especially the founders and people looking to start startups. So you can reach me LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, Daryl Frater. I use my first and last name for most of my handles. So that's DarrelFrater. And you can catch me on my app, you know, go to downloadtheclub.com and you can check out the club and, you know, we can have some virtual parties and we can turn up.
Yeah, man. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to having, you know, a bunch of people in there and having a blast. So I'm one of the early adopters and I'll stay using the product, just because I like product as well. So look forward to more things coming from your end, and people out there, go get the club app and tell your friends about it. All right. Till next week. Bye.